about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Jerry Darkus, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing the inland oceans. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Jerry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to the website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Jerry Darkus about fly fishing the inland oceans. Harper Creek Fly Fishing Company is North Carolina's premier backcountry fly fishing guide service. Located in Lenoir, North Carolina, at the base of the Blue Ridge Mountains, they fish some of the most beautiful limestone spring creeks North Carolina has to offer. Their guide has over 15 years of professional experience. In addition to their backcountry guide service for experienced anglers, they offer intensive full-day instructional trips for the novice angler. So go spend a day with them in fly fishing paradise. For more information on their services, please visit www.nc-flyfishing.com. That's nc-flyfishing.com. Or call them at 828-758-2446. That's 828-758-2446. Before we introduce Jerry, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Jerry's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We will also be giving away a copy of Jerry's book, Fly Fishing the Inland Oceans, courtesy of Stackpole Books. So here's how you can win Jerry's book. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talked about during the show. You must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll win Jerry's book. Our guest tonight is Jerry Darkus. Jerry is a fly tackle sales rep, writer, and instructional guide based in northern Ohio. He has over four decades of fly fishing experience in both freshwater and saltwater, and is recognized as an expert on Great Lakes steelhead and warm water fly fishing. Jerry has written many articles for a variety of fly fishing publications. Recently, he has been most active in promoting fly fishing on the waters of the Great Lakes. His first book, Fly Fishing the Inland Oceans, An Angler's Guide to Finding and Catching Fish in the Great Lakes, was released through Stackpole Publishing in September 2013. His second book, Fly Tyer's Guide to Tying Essential Bass and Panfish Flies, was just released by Lions Publishing. Well, Jerry, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hey, good evening. Thanks for having me on.
Well, good to have you here. Hopefully the weather out there in the Midwest is in the Great Lakes is shaping up a little bit better, huh?
Finally. It was a pretty long rough winter for us, but
pretty long winter.
Finally have a decent stretch of weather in front of us, it looks like.
Well, good. Well, tonight, you know, we plan to basically give everybody a nice tour, so to speak, of the Great Lakes, as you call them, inland oceans, because, boy, when you look at the Great Lakes, it sure looks like the ocean out there. Now, you know, when we think of the Great Lakes, we think of Lake Erie, Lake Huron, Lake Michigan, Lake Ontario, and Lake Superior, but you also list a sixth lake in your book. What is it and why?
Well, it's Lake St. Clair, which is generally, it's kind of put in with part of the Lake Erie system, but you know, the quality of the fishing it offers certainly is enough that it deserves to stand on its own. Really, it's a pretty remarkable body of water just for the quality of fishing that it offers and the accessibility of it.
Okay, well, we'll dig in more to, you know, specifically in that lake later in the show, but I just want to kind of highlight that because that kind of surprised me. And I was reading your book, I'm going, I never heard of that lake.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting. Even a few years back, American Angler magazine rated it as one of the top, like, 50 fly fishing destinations or something like that. So, it's received recognition, but on the other hand, it's really stayed off the radar screen, too. So, But it's a pretty interesting place.
Now, let's talk about the fish because, boy, there's a lot of fish available in the Great Lakes. What's the breakdown? For instance, you know, for warm water fish, what do most people target in the Great Lakes as far as warm water fish?
Well, from a fly fishing standpoint, really, smallmouth bass is king. They're found in all of the lakes in the system and in most of the connecting waters, and that very widely distributed. Even in Lake Superior, there's a couple areas that have really outstanding smallmouth fishing, and, you know, I think as far as a fly rod fish, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to find a fish better than smallmouth. You know, they're great fighters. They jump. They're generally pretty receptive to, you know, striking flies under most conditions. And they're actually pretty forgiving if you make a sloppy cast, too. So, you know, in my mind, I almost consider smallmouth maybe the ideal fly rod fish.
Okay. And what are some of the other warm water fish you target with those?
Well, you know, there's a variety of panfish that are available, depending on where you're at. You know, crappie, bluegill, sunfish, rock bass, yellow perch, white bass. You know, they're in the mix. There's parts of at least the, not Lake Superior, but the other lakes have pretty good largemouth fishing also, which has really been, you know, not even looked at hardly from a fly fishing standpoint, is the quality of the largemouth bass fishing. And of course, you know, in recent years here, carp have become kind of like, you know, an in fish for a lot of fly fishermen. And there's some great carp destinations around the Great Lakes, in particular Beaver Island, which has actually become almost an international fly fishing destination now. There's a small group of guides that work Beaver Island and the archipelago there for carp, and they have people come from literally all over the world to fish for them. Beaver Island is northern Lake Michigan, kind of almost in the middle to a certain extent, but it's northern part of Lake Michigan. It's about 30 miles offshore from the city of Charlevoix. And again, there's other groups of islands in northern Lake Michigan too, but Beaver Island is really become, you know, maybe the most recognized of all those locations. And then if we kind of hit a little bit of an overlap going from warm water to cold water species, you know, we might call cool water species, you've got northern pike and muskellunge, which are again very, very well distributed around the Great Lakes, and you know, certainly great fly rod fish, and as in a lot of places, you know, throughout the upper Midwest and other areas, you know, interest in fly fishing for muskies has really, you know, taken on a lot of importance here, again, over the last 4 or 5 years or so. So, and again, we've got a lot of places for muskie fishing around the lakes, too.
Yeah, it's funny how, like, well, muskie and carp both, and northern pike, have taken on, you know, people have gotten interested in those over the past 10, 15 years where you wouldn't, prior to that, you'd have never thought of fly fishing, you know, for one of those fish. And now they're so popular. So,
yeah,
that's great.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's great to see, you know, these various resources and species being utilized. You know, I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, just better equipment and better understanding how to use it and just fly development, you know, a combination of things, understanding the fish. But, you know, a lot of this has certainly opened up a lot of non-traditional fly fishing areas and species to us.
Right. And then what about cold water fish?
Well, as far as cold water species go, really the true native species of the Great Lakes from a cold water standpoint would be brook trout and lake trout. Lake trout are at present found in all five of the major Great Lakes. I don't think they're in Lake St. Clair. I've never heard of them. And they can be caught actually by fly in all five of the lakes. The brook trout are much less distributed, and the lake-dwelling form of brook trout are referred to as coasters, and their original range was Lake Superior and the northern parts of Lake Michigan and Lake Huron. And at present, they're found mainly in a few places in Michigan and Lake Superior, a few places in the Wisconsin waters, a little bit in Minnesota, around Isle Royale, which is, again, in the U.S., and then the northern, kind of the northwest tier of Lake Superior is where the coasters are found. And they were fished, almost overfished to extinction, the late 1800s, early 1900s, and just habitat issues and things like that. But they're actually starting to rebound, and the future for those is not, you know, is looking better than it was, let's put it that way. And you can actually, you know, for example, go up to northern Lake Superior and actually target coasters and, you know, be reasonably assured that you're going to catch them. Some of the other, whitefish are native species, and they are available catch on fly periodically, lake whitefish. You'll find them rising to insect hatches and that at times. And again, it's mainly a Lake Superior situation. And then, of course, we've got Pacific salmon, which were stocked in the late 1960s to control alewives, which were an invasive species that came in through the St. Lawrence and the Welland Canal. And at present, you know, there's king or chinook, cohos, silver salmon. There are pink salmon in the Great Lakes as far as Pacific salmon species, and there are restoration projects underway as far as bringing Atlantic salmon populations back again, especially in Lake Ontario. And there is a stocking program in the St. Mary's River for Atlantic salmon, which is the connector between Lake Superior and Lake Huron. So that's kind of a rundown on the major, you know, warm water and cold water species. And, you know, there's other things that, you know, fall into the mix that are caught occasionally. For example, I've caught some really big channel catfish on flies in Lake Erie, and then freshwater drum is another species which is a great fighting fish, but, you know, is not really well known, you know, in fly fishing worlds, but they're a close relative of like a redfish that we find
right.
in saltwater. So
right.
a lot of different opportunities out there for a variety of species to catch on a fly.
Now, when you talk about the salmon were brought in to control the alewives, how did that work out? Was that a success? You know, a lot of things that we do as humans when we mess with things, screw things up. And did that work out okay overall for the Great Lakes?
Well, the alewife populations are certainly much, much less than they were. So from that standpoint, you know, it definitely did. It did work out, and then the presence of the Pacific salmon, I mean, created an industry on its own just from, you know, offshore gear fishing, you know, trolling and that, and they're also now naturally reproducing in a number of rivers, especially in Lake Michigan. And, you know, again, that even when they come in the fall to spawn, that kind of has generated a small industry on its own too. And, you know, they're targeted with flies as well as other techniques. So, you know, as far as, I guess from that standpoint, we'd have to say, you know, that it was a success.
Yeah.
You know, what we're finding these days, like in Lake Huron, you know, to a variety of several reasons, but there's actually the alewife population has dropped dramatically in Lake Huron, and it's having an effect on the Chinook salmon. Where their numbers are starting to drop down. So, you know, big system, and we can have some effect on them, and there's also some effects we don't, you know, necessarily always see when we do things like that.
Right. And then, of course, we can't forget the steelhead either, right?
Right. And, you know, from a cold water standpoint, steelhead are probably the, you know, the most sought after fish, especially when they, you know, when they come in into the tributaries. And interestingly enough, these fish were first stocked in the lakes in the early 1870s. And so there's been, you know, stockings throughout the lakes. There's a number of naturalized, you know, wild populations of fish, as well as there's other areas, for example, you know, the South Shore Lake Erie where I'm from, where there is limited natural reproduction just because of temperature and water flow issues during, well, the summertime. So stocking is done to maintain those populations. But fly fishing for steelhead certainly is a very popular and important fly fishing activity, you know, in all the great, you know, in Great Lakes tributaries all over.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about the equipment. Now, you know, when you did your research and wrote your book, are you primarily doing shore fishing or are you using boats? And if you are using boats, what kind of boats are you using?
Well, it's a combination of things. You know, there's a number of areas, or actually quite a few, where there's good shore access to do different types of things. And you can utilize kayaks, canoes, float tubes, you know, all kinds of smaller personal watercraft, some situations. And there's also situations where you can utilize, you know, a powerboat of some sort. You know, there are a few guides around lakes that are running almost flat-style boats. And, you know, so it's a very saltwater type situation. But depending on what you're doing, you know, you may be wading, you may be standing on a pier or a jetty. You may be in a float tube or a kayak, or, you know, on your buddy's bass boat or something like that. So all these different things can be utilized to fly fishing in the Great Lakes.
Okay, okay. And maybe we can talk about this when we talk about the different lakes, but kind of interested in, you know, if there exists flats fishing type fishing, and maybe we can talk about that when we get into the specific lakes. So given all these, you know, the kind of water, all these different species of fish, and considering you know, you never know what you can hook up with, I suppose. It's kind of like salt water in that respect as well. But, you know, do you have kind of like a standard equipment set up as far as, you know, the weight of your rod and the kind of lines you carry so that you can be prepared for different situations?
Sure. I'll tell you, you know, the go-to rig day in and day out, you know, to cover most applications for most species would be a 9-foot 8-weight. You know, that's going to give you a lot of versatility to throw a lot of different fly sizes. It's, you know, maybe a little overkill for certain fish, like some of the panfish species or something like that. But as you said, you know, you're never quite sure what you might end up hooking. And the other thing, too, just like saltwater, you will have wind to contend with at times. So the 8-weight, you know, has a enough mass to it that you can handle it in a reasonable amount of wind, and you're not, you know, wearing yourself out casting it. So, you know, if I had one outfit to pick, that would certainly be the length and line weight, you know, to start off with.
You're also throwing some pretty decent sized flies too, right?
Well, at times, depending on what you're targeting. For example, later in the, you know, last half of the summer and going into the fall, when we're targeting muskies in particular, you know, we'll throw flies at times that are maybe upwards of 12 inches or longer in length to really, you know, try and match the size of the forage at that point. So, you know, the next step up from the 8-weight would be going to a 10-weight then, you know, for handling the bigger flies and some of the bigger fish, like muskies or king salmon or something like that. So those would be the two main rod sizes for the most part. And, you know, the majority of the time, the 8-weight would probably, you know, be the one that's used mostly.
Okay.
You know, looking at lines, we use a lot of, you know, the integrated sinking head lines. So, you know, my favorite is the Coastal Express line by Scientific Anglers. They do it in a 250 grain and a 350 grain, so it really matches the rods that we're using. And I really like that line because it performs well in a very wide range of temperatures, depending on where you're at and what you're doing. You know, you might be anywhere from 90 degrees, you know, air temperature and 75 degrees water to below freezing and, you know, 40 degree water temperature. And that line seems to work well across the board in a very wide range of water temperatures. So that, you know, we use that type of line most of the time. Anytime you're fishing probably in excess of 8 or 10 feet, you're going to go to the integrated sinking head line like that. Use clear tip lines fairly regularly too for fishing shallower water or at times like carp on the flats or chasing smallmouth on the flats where you just need to get down and maintain the fly at maybe, say, a 3 to 5 foot depth where even a floating line with a long leader will not allow you to keep the fly in that zone. Where there, the clear tip lines really, really shine. And also, you do run into, you know, super, super clear water situations. So I think that, you know, in shallow, clear water, those lines definitely have their place. And oddly enough, probably the least used line is a floating line where most lakes work. You know, when fish are in really skinny water, you can certainly use a floating line or there are opportunities, you know, to surface fish at times, too, and that's where the floating line, you know, would come into play.
Mm-hmm. Okay, okay. What about, you know, special terminal tackle for certain species? Do you have to be prepared for that?
Yeah, you know, generally, like with smallmouth and most of the general species, you know, what we use in, again, generally 10 to 12 pound at the tippet, somewhere in that range there. And again, I'll often run fluorocarbon on the end of the leader, last couple feet in fluorocarbon, again, especially in a super clear water situation. For the toothy critters, you know, you want to have some sort of a bite tippet on. And depending on who you talk to, you'll get different opinions on what that should be. There are some guys that like the tieable wire. There's other guys that, you know, would rather go with like a heavier fluorocarbon, like 60 or 80 pound fluorocarbon is bite tippet. You know, I've had experience with both and both work, and I can't say personally that one's, you know, better than the other. The other thing to keep in mind is like, again, in the fall type stuff when we're throwing these mega flies, you know, particularly for muskie, you've got to do a little bit of modification generally on the leader, too, just to get some of that stuff turned over. You know, we might run a short length of 30 or 40 pound and then step down to 20. Or, again, if you want to go for IGFA stuff down to your class tippet at that point and then your bite tippet on to the end of that. And usually, you know, we're running, you know, 12 to 15 inches of bite tippet. Again, if you want to go after IGFA certification for, you know, tippet class record or something, then you just want to make sure that everything's in line with what their specifications are.
Okay, okay. Well, Jerry, we need to take a quick break here, but stick with me. When we come back, we'll start digging into the lakes and seeing what we can learn about each one of those lakes. So we'll be right back.
Okay.
Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Jerry Darkus about fly fishing the inland oceans. If you'd like to ask Jerry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Jerry, I always ask my guests at this point in the show, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world? So tell us a little bit about what you're up to there in the Great Lakes.
Well, let's see. We're kind of probably, depending on where you're at around the lakes, starting to wind down a little bit on steelhead fishing. I actually was out a little bit today and did get a couple steelhead, but we also have lake-run smallmouth starting to show up, and that's kind of another little-known phenomenon, especially in the Lake Erie tributaries, is that, you know, we have migratory runs of smallmouth bass that come into the tributaries to spawn. And, you know, they're just starting to come in now, so the pre-spawn action on them can be pretty exciting. Other than that, let's see, I'm just trying to think here. Actually, you asked about flats fishing a little bit before. I just had an article in the most recent Fly Fisherman magazine that covers or has to do with flats fishing for Great Lake smallmouth. So there's a lot of flats around the lakes that, you know, have different species of fish on it. So it's something that can be done. And I'm also working on a third book, which is going to be basically a pattern encyclopedia type guide of fly patterns for the Great Lakes area and upper Midwest. And that'll cover lake as well as inland and kind of everything across the board. So, you know, got a lot of different things going on and definitely keeping busy.
Good, good. Now, do you guide up there, Jerry? Or are you?
I don't really guide too much anymore. I did a fair amount for a number of years seasonally, but the other parts of the other types of work I do have gotten, you know, a lot more time consuming, and I just kind of turned a lot of the guiding stuff over to some of the guys.
Okay, good. And I noticed we're going to kind of skip over talking about flies because there's just so many flies we could spend all night on flies. But
I'll give you a quick summary on flies. If you had one pattern to pick to carry with you, it'd be a size 2 chartreuse and white clouser deep minnow.
That's what I figured you'd say.
Yeah. Well, you can take that fly anywhere and certainly catch fish no matter where you're at. But great imitation of an emerald shiner, which is, you know, one of the primary forage species, you know, across the lakes. And again, you know, the variation of the clouser, the half and half, you know, those are two key patterns right there. But as you said, there's certainly a lot of other ones that can fit into the mix.
Okay. And in Jerry's book, Fly Fishing in the Inland Oceans, he's got I don't know how many pages here on flies. So a big section of the book devoted to different flies. So you want to
pick that up. Yeah, I think it's 160 patterns or so we ended up with.
Very interesting looking at those. I almost feel like I'm looking at saltwater flies when I'm looking at that, you know. So I guess.
Well, a lot of them, there is certainly a lot of crossover between how you fish and the equipment that you use. I mean, there is certainly similarities.
Yeah. We did get, Phil McCartney has sent in a couple of questions online here, Jerry. Maybe you can address these.
Okay.
He's talking about Castalupsa.
Castapalooza?
Castapalooza?
That's an event that I put on every spring.
Okay.
I do it on one of the local rivers here, and it's a kind of a celebration of fly fishing. We do it. It's free and open to the public. And it's kind of evolved into more of almost like a switch rod and two-hand casting day, because that's where, you know, a lot of the interest seems to be these days. But, yeah, that's kind of an event that I started doing about 5 years ago.
Yeah, well, Phil says he missed it because he didn't get the Facebook announcement and arrived the day after the event had happened. So he wants to know if he doesn't want to miss it next year, so he wants to know if a date and location have been set for next year.
It'll be Hidden Valley Park on the Grand River, Madison, Ohio, second Saturday in April.
There you go. Okay. And Phil also asked about, and we didn't really mention this, but he asked about walleyes and when they're most available for fly fishing techniques in the Great.
Okay. You know, walleyes are a tough one. They can be caught. The most success I've had is fishing structure areas at night, you know, reef areas, drop-offs, locations like that. And again, oddly enough, your clouser minnow is, at least from my standpoint, been probably the most productive pattern for it, and incorporating that with, you know, one of the integrated shooting head lines. You know, they seem to be pretty reluctant to hit a fly in the daytime. Again, this is my experience, but I found them very receptive to hitting a fly at night. So, but it'd be one of the harder species to really probably target and catch on a regular basis.
Okay, good. All right, let's kind of walk through the lakes here, talking first about Lake St. Clair. Maybe you can describe the lake and why you think it's such a great lake for fly fishing.
Okay, well, Lake St. Clair is 400 square miles. It's actually a, if you want to call it, a wide spot in the connector between southern Lake Huron and the western end of Lake Erie. It's fed by the St. Clair River coming out of Lake Huron, and then the Detroit River goes from Lake St. Clair into Lake Erie then. What really makes it is a great fly fishing destination is that the average depth of the lake is around 10 feet, and it is just an endless expanse of small rock piles, gravel bars, sand flats, weed edges. It has ideal spawning habitat for forage fish as well as, you know, the different game fish that inhabit it. And it stays relatively cool because it's fed by Lake Huron. It overturns its volume about every 20 days. So yeah, there's constantly turnover of water in Lake St. Clair. So it helps moderate the temperature through much of the year. So you can really effectively fish it starting, you know, almost at ice out, almost till ice up. And even during the warmer summer months of July and in August, it still fishes extremely well because there, other than the shipping channel, there really is no deep water for the fish to go into. In fact, you'll often will find fish right up on the flats in July and August in that. So, you know, it just really has a lot of opportunity. It's been ranked numerous times by various publications as probably the best smallmouth and muskie fishery, you know, anywhere these days, a combination of average size fish as well as numbers that are available. Interesting thing about Lake St. Clair, the west and north side is pretty much on much of the Detroit metro area. And in spite of that, you know, it still maintains a very, very high quality fishery. And the eastern and much of the southern side of it is Canadian side, or, you know, it's a border area. And part of that is a First Nation Walpole Island Reservation, or Walpole Reservation, so there's, you know, really very little development there. And much of the Canadian side is, you know, a few scattered cottages and things like that, but not any big development like you find on the U.S. side. But it's just, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was going to ask you about licensing, because you're dealing with water that is, you know, borders certain states and certain countries, Canada,
right,
and U.S. How does licensing work in the Great Lakes? Because that's
So there is no reciprocal agreement between any of the states or between the U.S. and Canada. There's
okay.
A number of border connecting areas that, you know, certainly have very high quality fly fishing. In addition to Lake St. Clair, we'd be looking at like the St. Mary's River, the Niagara River. But if you're on the Ontario side, you need to have an Ontario fishing license.
Where does that start? Is there a distance from shore, or how is that determined?
Well, if you're in a boat, your GPS will actually show you where the border is.
Oh, really?
You know, the lake maps and stuff, the plot maps and that. They used to have buoys out that showed border, but with GPS now they don't show those. But, you know, from a shore fishing aspect, it's very
easy. Obvious, yeah.
Yeah,
but for a boat, you do have to watch yourself, I suppose, then, huh?
Yeah, you do have to if you're in a boat. But again, these days, pretty much all done, you know, off GPS lake maps to show you exactly where your location is in that.
Yeah. So you had mentioned smallmouth and muskie, some of the better fish to target in that lake.
Yes.
Stand by that, or are there others that...
St. Clair also is really, really good largemouth bass fishing, which is totally overlooked because of the smallmouth fishing.
Okay.
It also has a lot of pike, but, you know, they're generally not, you know, big. They certainly don't achieve the size that they will in, you know, maybe some more harder to access waters and things like that. They just, but, you know, you will get pike up to 30 inches or so. in St. Clair, but what really shines is smallmouth bass fishing, where there's, you know, any cast you make, you've got a potential for a smallmouth in excess of 5 pounds.
Oh, wow. Wow, nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, and even a 5-pound fish really doesn't, you know, raise too many eyebrows or anything. It's a nice mm-hmm. fish, but not an unusual fish in Lake St. Clair.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk. Anything else that you would want to say about Lake St. Clair, fishing tactics or anything that are particular to that lake?
Well, you know, there is some pretty decent shore access early in the year. The Metro Beach area at the mouth of the Clinton River does have some good shoreline access. And I do, you know, kind of mention that a little bit in my book, as well as kind of around to the northeast a little bit more, the area around Harson's Island. Again, there is places where you can get in there and wade and target smallmouth in that too. So, and there is a number of areas that have, you know, you can get in with a kayak in that very easily. So it isn't just strictly a boat fishery.
Okay, okay, good. Okay, let's move on next door to Lake Erie and describe, you know, Lake Erie and how you see that and what it offers fly fishers.
Well, you know, Lake Erie is the shallowest of the Great Lakes. Average depth is somewhere around 30 feet in that range there. There is a couple areas that kind of have a bit of a fly fishing reputation at this stage of the game. Presque Isle Bay by the city of Erie is a enclosed bay, but connected to the main lake, and has great largemouth fishing in it, a lot of wade and shore access, a lot of small boat, even canoe, kayak, float tube kind of stuff, but it kind of has its reputation for its early season smallmouth bass fishing when these fish move in out of the main lake to set up the spawn in that. If you can catch them on pre-spawn, you can have some pretty good fishing, and a lot of it is in water that's fairly accessible and, you know, wadeable, maybe in the waist-deep range. So, you know, that's probably, at this stage, maybe the most known fly fishing area on Lake Erie. But, you know, over the years I've had good success, you know, fishing off certain break walls and pier areas, for example, Conneaut, town of Conneaut for steelhead net, you know, we'll get them up that area. I'm bouncing around a little bit here. The islands area in the western end of the lake certainly has a lot of reef and shoal areas where you can go in and target walleyes. Again, especially if you want to do the night game. There is smallmouth bass throughout the whole area. We've got white bass that, you know, move on to the shallow reefs to spawn. So there's, you know, that whole western end of the lake is pretty much all limestone, and wherever it's broken up a little bit and jagged, you're going to find smallmouth and that. So just a lot of different things to do there.
Now, do you get up in along the New York border there, do you start getting those lake run browns up there, or is that up in Ontario?
Yeah. That's, you know, the Lake Erie brown trout fishing, you know, is just starting, is kind of in development at this stage. They're being stocked by Pennsylvania and New York. Ohio is not stocking any. I don't think province of Ontario is. But once you get Pennsylvania and then east into New York, you've got some really good river mouth access and again, kind of seasonal stuff starting in probably mid-August through September and October. For browns and steelhead, and like from now through maybe middle of June for smallmouth bass in that. And again, some good harbor areas in addition to like Presque Isle. Dunkirk Harbor in New York is a very good area, easy to get to, and again, really good for small boat work or canoe, kayak kind of stuff. Mouth of, again, any of the small creeks, even in New York, are going to have, you know, hold fish seasonally, too. So
mm-hmm.
a lot of different things going on along that shoreline. I have a good friend who's a guide on the Ontario side, Paul Castellano, who does a lot of shallow water smallmouth fishing with fly, again, too much in July and August, where there's big rocky shallows anywhere from about 4 to 6 feet that have basically packs of bass up there, you know, cruising them in their chasing bait and that. So that's another thing that's kind of, you know, totally off the radar screen, but does exist.
What would you say Lake Erie is best known for as far as fly fishing, as far as the fish?
Smallmouth and steelhead.
Smallmouth and steelhead.
Yep, smallmouth and steelhead. It also has great fishing for white bass or silver bass, they're called, depending on where you're from. They're kind of a miniature relative of saltwater stripers. And all the rivers, you know, receive spawning, well, most of the rivers receive spawning runs of white bass, especially towards western end. The lower Detroit River gets a huge run of white bass, and, you know, these are fish that are in the 12 to 18 inch range, and you know, just great fun on a fly rod again.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's take a quick break here, Jerry, and when we come back, let's talk about Lake Ontario, and that's just to the northeast there, and so we'll be right back. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Jerry Darkus about fly fishing the inland oceans. If you'd like to ask Jerry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. Use the Q&A text box to send us your question, and we'll receive your question immediately and try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, moving on to Lake Ontario, Jerry. So how does Lake Ontario differ from Lake Erie?
Well, Lake Ontario is much more of a, you know, has a lot more cold water depth to it. You know, it still has a significant population of both Chinook salmon and coho, silver salmon, a lot of steelhead, and, you know, it's got a lot of lake trout. You know, so from a cold water standpoint, it's definitely very significant. Although, you know, shoreline areas around the lake, even on the Ontario side, have good warm water fishing, again, smallmouth bass kind of rural, but there is good largemouth fishing in places. There's, again, good areas for northern pike scattered, you know, around the lake too, you know, more near shore areas and that. So you have a combination of things going on Lake Ontario. Even, you know, you look at the city of Toronto on the Canadian side, you know, there's the Toronto Islands, and, you know, there's good fishing all around the harbor islands right in the city of Toronto, as well as several really good river mouth areas that are close by that, you know, have, again, good seasonal opportunities for, you know, any of the migratory species. So, you know, there is a lot, again, like all the lakes, there is a lot of opportunity in Lake Ontario.
Mm-hmm. From a general standpoint, are all the lakes pretty clean nowadays? You know, I know we went through years ago a period of time where, like, Lake Erie was really terrible, and so forth. But are they all, you know, relatively clean now?
You know, yeah. I mean, there's certainly, since Clean Water Act, there's been, I mean, huge strides made, you know, as far as improving, you know, water quality. You can look at, you know, another infamous place was, if you kind of turn back the history book a little bit, is the Love Canal, which was just a huge toxic waste dump that was seeping into the Niagara River. And, yeah, at present, you know, the Niagara River is, which is the connector between Lake Erie and Lake Ontario, is just has wonderful fly fishing on it. So, and, you know, I would rate that as probably one of my favorite locations of all the fly fishes, from the lower Niagara River below the falls, because you can, it's got great shore fishing. It has, you know, certainly you've got things you can do out of a boat there. And it's almost a 365 year-round fishery. You know, with just the switchover species as the seasons change. And you can access it from shore from both the U.S. and Canadian sides. So, but, you know, to answer your question, in general, yes, the lake's much better. There's probably the most significant issue we're dealing with, at least from a pollution kind of standpoint, would be non-point source farm runoff, especially in Lake Erie, where, you know, high phosphate fertilizers are linked to algae blooms, which are linked to other issues and things like that. So, you know, that's something that has to be, you know, monitored, and they're making some adjustments even to types of fertilizers and that as we speak again. But in general, you know, the lakes are in really, you know, considering what we saw back in the 1950s and early 60s, things are in much better shape than they were.
Now, what about access? At least I'm sure you're more familiar with the U.S. shore than the Canadian shore, but is most of the shore public access, or are there private areas that you can't access from shore?
Well, it varies somewhat from state to state. Again, pretty much anywhere, if your feet are wet, you're pretty much good to go just about anywhere, as far as I'm aware of. But, you know, there are certain areas, you know, cutting across land and that, on dry land, where, again, you're going to have, there's certainly private property that you need to be aware of. But the other thing, though, is there's literally hundreds of county, city, state, and even national, you know, forest areas, parks, and that have really, you know, really good access to really good water. So there really isn't, in most cases, you know, I don't think you're going to be running into any major problems.
There was another, Phil just sent in another question, and he was, since we're talking about quality of water and so forth, he said zebra mussels were once a big problem. Are other invasive species that are impacting the lakes now?
Well, you know, I mean, that's an ongoing thing. You know, most of these invasives, for the most part, you know, kind of have the big boom of in population when they are first make it into the system. Then they kind of reach an equilibrium point over a period of time. Zebra mussels are certainly found across all the Great Lakes now and have made it into a lot of the inland lakes around the area and different waterways. They've changed things to a certain extent in that they've, you know, made the water much clearer than it was before. So they're part of the system, and, you know, things have seemed to adjust to it. Obviously, one thing that's on everybody's radar screen in this area right now is the Asian carp issue. You know, these fish that were brought in for weed control in commercial fish farms down south that made it into the Mississippi River and have, you know, worked their way north and are at the doorstep of Lake Michigan, although they've got, you know, some barriers and structures in place to, you know, keep them out. Long term, what's going to happen with that is we're still up in the air. But probably the most, you know, the invasive species that's still probably causing the most damage as far as from a affecting fish is the sea lamprey. And those came in again when the St. Lawrence Seaway and Welland Canal was opened in the 1950s. They came in, and they're basically a parasitic type. I'm not sure if they're classed as a fish or something like that, but they attach themselves onto a host fish and basically feed on the body fluids and that of that fish. And, you know, they were blamed and impacted the native lake trout populations very significantly when they first came in. They still are a big issue. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife treats the tributary waters with lamprecide on a regular basis, but they are not close to being eradicated at all. So we found them on pretty much all species of fish, from lake trout to steelhead and browns. We found them on smallmouth bass. We found them on walleye. We found them on white bass. So, you know, it's not just a cold water species thing. They can affect, you know, a wide range of fish species. So that's certainly one that, you know, is definitely a major issue at this point still.
Okay. Let's move on to Lake Huron then. Tell us about Lake Huron.
Lake Huron is a very interesting body of water. Certainly the northern or upper half of it is pretty much considered more or less a cold water type habitat, although again, near shore areas certainly have their distribution of warm or cool water species. Georgian Bay, which is again a significant part of the northern, or well, be the northeast corner of Lake Huron, is Georgian Bay itself is nearly the size of Lake Ontario. So it's a vast area, and it's also called the 30,000 Islands because it has all kinds of little reefs, rock piles. Again, large islands, small islands, and all these are, you know, fish structure, fish spawning habitat. It's a very, very extensive area that, again, from a has received some notice, you know, throughout the gear fishing world, but from a fly fishing standpoint, again, one of these places that's been pretty much off the radar screen, but again, it has a musky fishery that is producing fish, you know, in the 60-pound class, which you're getting up into world record size fish. Only a few people are even focusing on that. And again, you've got, again, pike fishing, largemouth and smallmouth in nearshore areas, as well as rivermouth and, you know, just a whole variety of different things available to you. The connector between or Lake Superior and Lake Huron, the St. Mary's River, again, this is one of these connecting waters that has a very significant fly fishing opportunity. And it's one area around the Great Lakes that does have a bit of a fly fishing history to it. The St. Mary's Rapids have been written, you know, going back in excess of 100 years as far as a destination, you know, for fishing and, again, with a focus on fly fishing to it. Originally with brook trout, and now that's shifted over to since the late 1800s, early 1900s, you know, to a steelhead type situation. And, again, now has the Pacific salmon available there, as well as Atlantic salmon in the St. Mary's River, too. So,
yeah, and I'm just looking at my map here of the Georgian Bay and North Channel there. And there, yeah, I mean, island after island, and a lot of connecting waterways and lakes along the shoreline, too. It's like water world up there, it looks like.
Well, here's the thing that most people even people that live here can't even comprehend the volume of water that's out there. You know, if you took the shoreline areas of the Great Lakes, it's longer than the length of the east and west coast of the U.S., at least, you know, discluding Alaska. I mean, you've got just like 11,000 miles of shoreline in the Great Lakes. You know, and you've got 20% of the fresh water on Earth is found in the Great Lakes. So there's just so much there that, you know, it's even hard to comprehend.
Yeah, a lifetime of fishing right there, huh? Yeah.
A lifetime just on, you know, one lake, actually.
There
barely scratched the surface. I mean, there's a lot out there. I mean, and there's only a few people that are, you know, that even paid attention to it so far from a fly fishing standpoint.
Well, a lot of Lake Huron is Canadian there, it looks like. Certainly,
sure.
You know, with the Georgian Bay and North Channel there and so forth. And that's kind of what you focused on. What about the west side of the lake over on Michigan?
You know, there's some good there's some really good harbor and rivermouth areas on the Lake Huron side. You know, maybe one of the, as far as narrowing it down to a couple, the area around Tawas, Michigan, Tawas Point has got a great, right at the lighthouse there, has a great flat for carp and smallmouth bass, again, especially through the months of May and June. You look at the area around the mouth of Saginaw Bay, Port Austin, that area there, great, great shoreline smallmouth fishing, again, just starting to get into that time frame now, and that'll last till the middle of June or so, and there's good shoreline access, good wading areas where you can actually wade out and target smallmouth in that. Mm-hmm. And there's the mouth of the Akiak River. You know, these are just some of the things that are coming to mind for both warm water, cold water species, the mouth of the Sheboygan River. So there's just, you know, the list goes on and on when it comes to stuff like that. In Oscoda, Michigan, the lower Ossabel River is, you know, steelhead, and the browns are coming back again, as well as smallmouth and other species like that. So
I want to make note, too, in Jerry's book, you know, Fly Fishing Inland Oceans, He's got the different areas on the different lakes broken down, and for each section, he'll tell you what the primary species are and the peak times by months, you know, when you should be there. Also, useful patterns for that areas for the specific kind of fish. And then he breaks down also the fly shops and guide information for that area. So really, you know, if you're looking to fish an area, you really should get Jerry's book, and that, you know, that really gives you a good starting point to fish an area. And if you're unsure, then he gives you the local shops and guides there to get connected with, and so you can really, you know, dig in and learn the water. So anyway, that's really nice, Jerry, that you have that in the book. I think that's great.
Yep.
Let me take a quick break here again, then we'll finish up with Michigan and Superior, okay? Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible to make your own bamboo fly rods? With the help of Power Fibers online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod maker profiles, the classic papers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit their website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Jerry Darkus about fly fishing the inland oceans. If you'd like to ask Jerry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Jerry, let's talk about Lake Michigan then, probably one of the better-known lakes out of the Great Lakes. What does Lake Michigan offer that maybe the other lakes don't offer?
Well, Lake Michigan is the only Great Lake that's totally within the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing about it. And you've got, you know, certainly some very extensive urban areas, particularly looking at the city of Chicago. But there's actually doable fly fishing right along the Chicago lakefront, you know. So it's even in spite of all that, it still has fly fishing opportunities there. Lower half of the lake is most of the shoreline is real sandy. There's actually Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore on the south end of the lake, and you've also got another National Lakeshore Sleeping Bear Dunes up on the north end of the lake. So you've got some very picturesque areas like that, but you run into, farther north you go, you get run into more rock, and obviously rock means smallmouth bass in a lot of cases, and once you get up into that area too, you northern end of the lake, you run into hard limestone flats, and that's where, you know, a lot of the carp fly fishing is taking place these days. I know we talked about Beaver Island area earlier, but other places would be like around Traverse City, Michigan, Grand Traverse Bay, Little Traverse Bay are areas where you can get out on flats and look for and cast to cruising carp, and you'll find, you know, smallmouth and that up there at times. On the other side of the lake, Door County, Wisconsin, which is the big peninsula that sticks out starting around the town of Green Bay, has got, you know, great fly fishing really around the whole peninsula. Again, it's mainly focused on smallmouth bass, again, carp again, a lot of places where you can actually get out and wade and fish. And again, you've got seasonal opportunities for, you know, some of the migratory fish, for example, brown trout, steelhead, and Pacific salmon species and that. Mm-hmm. And kind of the same situation on the, if you look at the south side of Michigan's Upper Peninsula, too, looking at, you know, across their towns of Escanaba and Menominee and places like that, for example, the mouth of Menominee River going into Lake Michigan, you could run into just about anything that swims in the lake there, you know, depending on time of year and stuff. So a lot of opportunities around Lake Michigan, a lot of good shoreline access. There's numerous harbors that have piers and breakwalls where you've got, you know, fly fishing opportunities, as well as utilizing small personal watercraft or you know, getting out, you know, in a bigger boat if you have access to it.
We got a question from Larry Hall in Indian River, Michigan. He says, early June in northern Lake Michigan, how would you target the smallmouth in the shallows? And he says, off of, I guess it's Wagashant's Point?
Wagashant's Point? Wagashant's, well, again, that's one of those areas that has great shoreline access, and you'd probably there use, for the most part, a clear tip or floating line because you're dealing with water that's going to be probably 3 to 5 feet deep for the most part. And I would have, again, I would have my Clouser minnows with me and maybe certainly that size 2 range in a couple different shades, chartreuse and white, maybe all white in a gray and white or olive and white just to have a little bit of variation. The other thing that we'll often fish the cruising smallmouth, especially when they're just getting ready to go on their spawning beds, is a fly called the Killy Bugger, which is actually a trout fly, but it's kind of has a copper cactus chenille body with either black and yellow, brown and yellow marabou tail, and it generally has yellow rubber legs coming off of it. And that's a good fly to throw in front of stationary fish and just let it kind of drift down in front of them. And actually, I think probably some of the stuff's covered in that article I just did in Fly Fisherman, too, that kind of goes into some of this stuff like that, too. But so those types of flies, and that Tequila fly I'll also do in a olive and orange, and then kind of a sleeper color for smallmouth would be black and pink, you know, if they're being particularly stubborn on a given day. That can be a color combination that can really change things dramatically for you.
Another question Larry had was, he says, in late May or very early June, when my friends are suspending dead smelt below bobbers for northern pike cruising the shallows, I'd like to pull out the fly rod. What approach would you suggest for me?
Well, there I'd probably, again, I'd work mainly with probably the clear tip line at that point, because you're fishing the upper part of the water column. Probably you want to fish down 3 to 5 feet maybe, and something like a, you know, as far as a basic fly pattern, a lefty's deceiver would certainly be something to try. But I'll often fish almost like a gearhead diver type fly on a floating line, on either a sink tip or that slow sinking line, because white rabbit strip driver or a white and gray one, maybe in about 5 inches long with a little bit of flash on it, I would certainly give that a go. Nice thing about using it on that clear tip line is that as you're retrieving it, you know, the line will pull it under the surface a little bit, but when you stop your strip, you know, it'll actually just kind of hover. It won't float all the way up to the surface, nor will it sink. So it kind of has that neutral buoyancy to it, and that can be really effective in situations like that. So that I would probably work with a deer hair, a rabbit strip diver, again, maybe a couple different colors, and fish it on a clear tip line.
Okay. Let's finish up here with Lake Michigan, and hopefully we'll have time for a few more questions that have come in here, just kind of on different topics here. But Lake Superior is what I meant to say. The northernmost lake and probably the coldest. I know I used to live in Duluth, and I believe
it was
the coldest. The coldest place I ever lived, and I lived in Anchorage, Alaska, too. So, that is a cold piece of water and land up there, that's for sure.
So, absolutely, absolutely.
That's my take on Lake Superior.
Well, Lake Superior is big and deep and certainly cold. So, again, you know, talking a little bit about just the size of these lakes and just how big they are. 10% of the fresh water on the planet is in Lake Superior. Just put that into your head a little bit and just think about that. Lake Superior is pretty much, you know, river mouth kind of stuff. You know, Duluth Harbor actually is a great musky destination these days. And in September and early October, I mean, if you know where some of these weed beds are that are starting to die off, you can really have good musky fishing. The mouth of the St. Louis River, the lower St. Louis River, good warm water fishery, you know, walleye, white bass, smallmouth, pike, you know, kind of the whole mix of stuff there. Going up the north shore of Minnesota, you know, you've got all kinds of river mouth opportunities there. You know, they've got the Kamloops rainbows, which they target in usually early spring, late February, March, into April. They're not really, they're different than a steelhead. They don't really ascend the rivers in the same way that steelhead do, but, you know, they will move into the river mouse to feed. And again, I'm going to bounce around a little bit here. Ashland, Wisconsin, Shuquamakon Bay is, again, one area that's had a bit of a fly fishing history to it now, going back a couple decades now. It's got very, very restrictive smallmouth keep limits on it, and it really has wonderful fly fishing for really, really big smallmouth. You know, the average fish is probably going to be in the 18-inch, you know, 3 to 3.5 pound range. It's got to be accessed for the most part by boat, though. So, and I do talk about how to do that a little bit in my book, as well as there's a couple really top-notch guides in the area that can help you out.
What about the Apostle Islands or Isle Royale?
Isle Royale is certainly the kind of one of the last strongholds for coastal brook trout in the U.S. And again, that's kind of a river mouth or, you know, shoreline reef, fishing off points and things like that. And you can also catch lake trout from shore around Isle Royale. Apostle Islands, limited, I think, opportunity there just because it gets fairly deep off them. I think some of the Back Bay areas and that, you can run into pike and things like that. But Isle Royale definitely has, you know, coaster and lake trout availability to you. You know, then you've got all a variety of different towns along the Michigan shoreline, Marquette and such, which have, again, river mouth and near shore fly fishing opportunities around them also. See, heading up again towards Thunder Bay and around the whole north shore of Lake Superior, pretty much every river mouth is a magnet for fish species there. And you're looking at a variety of different things depending on time of the year, but you've got, again, coasters, the lake-dwelling brook trout, you've got Pacific salmon, you've got lake trout early and late in the season, and again, you've got steelhead.
How big do the coasters get?
You know, they're generally in the 16 to 20-inch range. Mm-hmm. There's some fish that are, you know, as they're starting to come back, that are, you know, in excess of that 25-inch range now and starting to approach double digits again. So, you know, the Nipigon strain of fish was historically the largest brook trout that there were. And it seems that some of those genetics are still surviving, and these fish are beginning to get very, very big again if given the opportunity to do so. But most coasters are going to be, again, 16 to 20 inches with some bigger than that. Genetically, they're the same as stream-dwelling brook trout, so they've never been put on the endangered species list. Behaviorally, they are totally different. And this has all been documented. You know, they know that these fish exist, they're lake-dwelling, and they come in to spawn, and then they drop out again. But, you know, as far as trying to reclass or find that they're different genetically, that has not been proven yet. So,
yeah. Okay. We've got a few questions, kind of backpedal here a little bit. I want to try to get them answered. Tyler in New York says he lives there, Lake Ontario. Mm-hmm. He says you can find, pardon me?
Okay. No, I said okay.
Okay. Lake Ontario. He said you can find ample information on the seasonal movements of salmonoids, but limited information on the movement of pike into the big and small bays where you find flywater. With a New York fishing season that begins in May, I'm guessing the spring window has got to be pretty tight before they head back out into 30 feet of water. Any tips on getting my timing right for these, for the pike? Are there certain structure features that you're looking for when prospecting bays for pike? Will they return to the shallow bays in the fall, or is this a springtime only deal?
you know, it's more of just a springtime only deal. And, you know, as far as the way the season goes, the best opportunity is kind of dependent on how weather conditions have been, you know, prior to that. This year in particular, you know, pike should be available, you know, well into the to the open season time frame, just because, you know, it's been so cold. Generally, you know, right after ice out, they'll be hanging around darker, soft bottom areas that tend to get warmer quicker than the main lake areas. So those are generally the first places they're going to be found. You know, that's where they spawn. They don't build a nest or anything. They're broadcast spawners. So the female just basically distributes the eggs over an area. The males distribute the milk over an area. So you're not going to find spawning beds for them, but they will be on those dark bottom areas. And they'll hang in there for probably, I'm going to say, a couple weeks, and then they'll slowly start moving back out to deeper water. One place I would look for them, if there's any kind of marinas or places like that, you know, in these bays that, you know, he has access to, take a look at those, especially before, you know, the pleasure boats get in. And a lot of places, you know, the boating season doesn't really start to Memorial Day. So we've found that pike, you know, really seem to have an interest in hanging around these unoccupied marinas all across the lakes. And I'm sure it's because they draw a lot of bait fish, and again, the pike are there, you know, post-spawn feeding again.
Okay, and on one last question here from came in on the Internet from Larry Hall again. Thanks, Larry, for all your questions tonight. When targeting cruising brown trout in spring in northern Lake Huron, how shallow can you find them? Is it wadeable water, or do you need a boat to go after the brown trout?
It's probably will be a combination of both, depending on how, you know, if you've got a little bit of depth coming in fairly close to a wadeable area, it's certainly, you know, worth targeting. I know that over on the Lake Michigan side, that even before the main lake is opened up and the harbor areas are open, that the browns will be in the harbors cruising and chasing bait, and they'll be right under the surface often, because again, a little warmer water, that's where the bait fish are going to be, and that's where the predators are going to be. And that would be another situation for using the clear tip line. So I would suspect that, again, it would be a similar situation as that in Lake Huron. Bottom line is, if the bait's there, you know, the fish are going to be there. So if you can locate good combination or good, you know, significant numbers of bait, the fish will probably be there. I mean, there's times where, again, I'll just use Tawas City for an example, that, you know, you can catch fish offshore in the Tawas area. Or again, you know, the Akiak River, you know, you can catch them in areas like that at times. But I would concentrate on river mouths or harbor areas, you know, something that's going to draw the bait fish in and something that'll draw the browns in then.
Okay, terrific. Thanks, Jerry. We've run out of time, so we need to wrap things up here. But, Jerry, stick with me because we're going to give away your book here in a few minutes and a couple other great gifts. We're going to be giving away 1-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, as well as Jerry's book, Fly Fishing in the Oceans, courtesy of Stackpole Books. So stick with us here for a few more minutes, and maybe you'll win one of the prizes tonight. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature and support network, which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of trout, flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and to learn how you can help support their retreats, visit www.reelingandhealingmidwest.org, reelingandhealingmidwest.org, or call them at 866-237-5725. That's 866-237-5725. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link under our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, "What did you think of the show?" Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Okay, well, now it's time to give away our prizes, and these are from our drawings, which are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register yet for tonight's show, it's a little too late, but do so for our next show so you can have a chance to win one of these great prizes. Now, if you are the lucky winner, we will contact you after the show to provide you with information on how to receive your gift, so look for information on that via email. Now, the first thing we'll be giving away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And to learn more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. The organization's international, deals with both, you know, cold, warm water, and salt water, so it's a great organization to support. And let me see who our winner for that is. Looks like Richard Colley in Alberta, Canada. So Richard Colley in Alberta, Canada, congratulations. I know you'll enjoy your membership to the Federation. And anybody else that is interested, like I said, go to fedflyfishers.org. And you can join yourself there. Now, second thing we're going to give away tonight is a one-year subscription, Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, which you can learn more about at amottobooks.com. And our winner there is Jeff Stevens in California. So congratulations, Jeff. So Richard and Jeff will contact you after the show and get some information from you and then get your prize out to you. Okay, now time to give away Jerry's book, and of course very appropriate for tonight's show, Fly Fishing the Inland Oceans, and Jerry covers all the Great Lakes and very extensively there, so it'll be very helpful to you. And let's see, we're going to make this easy tonight. The question is, Jerry mentioned a place in, actually he mentioned two places, but either one will do. That's a great place to go carp fishing in Lake Michigan. What is one of those destinations that he mentioned? Great place to go carp fishing in Michigan where they've got some flats and stuff to fish. So let's see, Jerry, if we get an answer here. See how well they paid attention. Mentioned this a couple times, actually. Oh, still waiting. Come on, that was a pretty easy one. Anybody out there? No guesses? Come on, guys, gals. That was an easy one. Should have been. Okay, no takers on this. Again, the question is, good carp fishing in Lake Michigan. Where was the destination within the lake there that we mentioned? I wonder if my system's working here. I'll try something else. How many Great Lakes are there out there? How many Great Lakes? Let's see if somebody gets it. I'm wondering if my system is working here. I'm not getting anything coming through. Oh, here, finally. And it's the answer to the first question, which Dale suggests Beaver Island. Is that the right answer for us here, Jerry?
Sounds good to me.
Sounds good to you. Some good carp fishing there, huh? Okay, good. Well, Dale, congratulations. You just Dale's in Durham, North Carolina, a bit away from the Great Lakes, but now he's going to have a book and a guide to take him there and catch lots of fish. So congratulations, Dale. Hey, Dale, in that same text box, please send me your mailing address so that we can get this book sent out to you from Stackpole. And, again, congratulations, and thanks for playing and being attentive. All right. Okay, well, Jerry, hey, thanks for being on the show tonight. I know now none of you knew this, but Jerry's sitting in the car on the side of the road doing this show. Now, what dedication is that, huh?
On the way home from steelhead fishing.
Yeah, the way home from steelhead. This almost beats one of the other interviews I did, Jerry. I did an interview with one of my guests, and he was sitting under a palm tree down on the Mexican coast in his car. So he could get a cell phone signal, you know, for his, that's the only place he could get cell phone coverage. So, anyway, that was another kind of funny one. So, but hey, thanks for being with us, and I appreciate you taking your valuable time out with us tonight and sharing all your experience, and, it was very informative. So thanks.
Great. Well, I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
You're welcome. Now, hopefully everybody else has been out and filtered through our archive. If you're new to Ask About Fly Fishing, I just want to point that out. On the bottom of each page is the archive. You can dig in, and we have over 190 shows in the archive now on all kinds of different things, from different kinds of fish to location, types of fishing, techniques, everything. So go ahead and explore that. I'm sure you'll find something there that you like and lots of things to learn. Our next broadcast will be on May 21st, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, I'm going to interview Chip O'Brien. And our topic for the show will be California's best fly fishing. Chip was a professional guide in California for 18 years, and he's going to provide us with an overview of California's wild trout waters from really Northern California over into the Eastern Sierra, basically the upper part of the state there where wild trout exist. So join us for that show and learn more about California fly fishing. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Harper Creek Fly Fishing Company, Front Range Anglers, Housatonic River Outfitters, and Power Fibers Online Magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, and we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Again, that's 1-800-985-1673. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.